Have the House Human Resources Committee to order. And I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM 8. Senator Yee.
Is it all right if I have, this is Mike Dallum to come up and this is Mike Cunningham to come up?
Certainly.
Thank you. For the record, I'm State Senator May Yee, representing Senate District 19, consisting of portions of Lynn and Benton County. I'm here to ask for your support of Senegon Memorial 8, calling for increased awareness and more funding for the research, treatment, and cure of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, more commonly known as Lou Gehrig disease. Senegon Memorial 8 passed the Senate unanimously on April 20th. ALS affects 30,000 Americans every year and about 150 Oregonians. Sadly, almost 5,000 new cases are reported here in the United States. Once thought to be uncommon, we now know that ALS is as common as multiple sclerosis. ALS usually strikes men who are over 50 years of age. However, in some cases, they are in their 20s and 30s. ALS deteriorates motor neurons. Eventually, the ALS patient becomes completely paralyzed, though with no loss of mental capacity. The life expectancy of an ALS patient is about 2 to 5 years from the date of diagnosis. Today, there's no cure for ALS. There's no proven therapy either. More federal support is needed for research into the causes, prevention, treatment, and a cure for this debilitating disease. SAM 8 will help to send an important message to Congress, and I urge your passage of Senegon Memorial 8. At this time, I would like to introduce again Mrs. Mike Dallum, and she's going to present testimony to you.
My name is Mike Dallum, and I want to testify about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease. My life has changed dramatically since I was diagnosed October of 1997. Until I had a tracheostomy, I was an editor at Harvey Editor for the Times in Brownville, the weekly newspaper. I am now reliant on a nurse, and family took care for me. It is a relentless illness, as I now am fed through a tube in my stomach, and I breathe with a ventilator. And I have lost the ability to speak. I am here to ask you to help by asking for more research to find a cure. Right now, the Federal Drug Administration is now holding a medicine called amyotrophin that may help people with Lou Gehrig's disease. The intrusion into my life and the way it has affected my family is traumatic. Anything you can do to help would be appreciated.
Thank you very much.
If you have any questions, you can answer them.
Any questions?
Just a word of appreciation. Thank you for making the big effort to come here. We very much appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Ann Stipe, and I'm speaking on behalf of Mike Cunningham. He is a friend of mine. He teaches with my husband at West Albany High School. I'm going to read, and he has written for you. Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Mike Cunningham. I reside in Albany, Oregon, where I live with my wife, Janelle, and daughters, Jenna, age 10, and Ashton, age 5. I have been employed at West Albany High School both as a teacher and coach for the past 9 years. I was diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as ALS, and Lou Gehrig's disease on November 28, 1997, 4 months following my 30th birthday. At the time of my diagnosis, I was given no hope for treatment or cure. I believe together we can change this. I come before you today with hopes that you will realize the same sense of urgency felt by those afflicted with ALS. As I am sure you know, ALS is a neurodegenerative disease that robs its victims of their ability to move voluntary muscle, including muscles responsible for speaking, swallowing, and breathing. The average lifespan of a person afflicted with ALS ranges from 2 to 5 years, with death ultimately resulting from respiratory failure. The person's intellect remains intact, however, rendering them totally aware of their daily degeneration, as well as the fear of what lies ahead. There is no question regarding the devastating nature of ALS, but the anguish pales in comparison when one considers the fact that we are dealing with a very treatable and curable disease. There are currently 30,000 people living with ALS in the United States, with 5,000 new cases and 5,000 deaths resulting each year. Statistically classified as an orphan disease, ALS often goes unnoticed when allocating funds for research. The fact that ALS has been among us for over 100 years and has claimed hundreds of thousands of lives has also gone unnoticed. Generating advocacy for ALS is extremely difficult because the majority of ALS victims are either dead or severely disabled, rendering them unable to advocate for themselves. This leaves a very small percentage of ALS victims who are capable of speaking out. It is incomprehensible to me that we have allowed 100 years to pass without giving ALS the serious attention and proper funding it deserves. We are in great need of others, like yourselves, to help us in this seemingly impossible situation of raising awareness and funding to further ALS research. Recently, the ALS community has seen some initiatives at the national level to raise ALS awareness, shown in the recent commemorative bill passed by the U.S. Senate, designating the month of May as National ALS Awareness Month. However, while raising awareness is important, allocating funds for research is critical. We are not dealing with a hopeless cause. It just seems as such because of the limited time and resources designated toward it. ALS research at this time is very promising, yielding many possible treatments and theoretical cures. We have gained more knowledge regarding the possible mechanisms of ALS in the past 5 years than we have in the entire history of the disease. However, the lack of funding for further research has severely hindered our ability to move forward. We rely heavily on overflow research from other neurodegenerative diseases, such as Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, and Alzheimer's. It is time ALS be brought to the forefront and be treated with the same sense of urgency as these more publicized diseases. I realize it is difficult for you to feel the grave sense of urgency regarding this terrible disease without having lived it firsthand. Some of the ALS community have bonded together and used the acronym WIN, which stands for Whatever Is Necessary. I hope by my being here, sharing my thoughts and experience with you, that you are moved to do whatever is necessary. Better treatment and a cure should be made a priority and are long overdue. We thank you for this opportunity to address you today, and please, we encourage you to act swiftly. Mike Cunningham, WIN.
Questions? What's in the minute?
Thank you, Mike, for being here. Is there a, maybe it's in here, the combination of people coming together, is there a national foundation there?
Yes, ALSA.
ALSA?
Yeah.
Is the name of it, and it's national organization, international as well?
Yes. No. American.
It's an American. It's national as well.
Could we get information about that national organization? Could you include that?
Yes.
In your with your testimony at a future time.
Mm-hmm. We'll do that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Another question. Thank you very much for coming.
Yeah.
Thank you.
David Kale.
I was going to speak on behalf of my hospital.
Okay.
I had an appointment and she read it for me, so thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Greg Hanneman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Craig Hanneman. I reside at 4350 Gibson Road, Salem. One of the named individuals in the Senate Joint Memorial Aid is Chad Risley. Chad and I were roommates at Oregon State University beginning almost 30 years ago. Chad, in a sense, beat the odds. He survived for 17 years, and his life during that span, I can tell you, was an inspiration to his family and friends beyond anything that I have ever observed from anyone in my life. Tragically, on Sunday, Mother's Day, Chad died. Tomorrow is his service. Bob Jeremiah is not named on the bill. Another friend of mine in college, Bob died last Monday of Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and a year before that, another teammate of ours, Jim Sheely, died of ALS, Baltimore, Oregon State. And having spent many, many weekends traveling between here and Roseburg to see Chad and Cottage Grove to see Bob, I've been fortunate to observe the strength that those individuals have shown, the courage, and again, the inspiration to others. But it's a disease that deserves the support of people in Washington in terms of research. And doing this today, I think, would be very appropriate given the death of my closest friend and roommate for over 3 years. And I would appreciate your support. I just wanted to share that with the committee.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Well, you need to come up and identify yourself.
David Kale. I'm Mike Cunningham's best friend. And he also played football at Oregon State. And I don't know if that was brought up when I wasn't in here or not. But it seems to be a large coincidence that so many people with that have had trauma to their spinal cords, which is a high correlating factor with ALS, have had that. And that's our whole point and why we need more funding so that those things can be researched.
Mr. Chairman, I would just add to that. In the case of Bob Jeremiah, just a little story. Bob played in probably one of the greatest football games in the history of the state. That was the Giant Killer win over USC in 1967. And the night after that game, he left for boot camp. He had lost his 2S deferment and went into the Army, went to Vietnam after completing boot camp, and then had his eye shot out, and he was traumatized, of course, subsequent to his football career as well. But it is an interesting linkage, and I guess that's what research maybe can help in part determine if there is, in fact, that linkage, and it's not just anecdotal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Interesting
linkage. Closed public hearing on SJM 8 and open work session.
I'm SJM 8 to the 4
of the Supac. Representative Winters has made the motion. Is there any discussion?
This strikes close to home too, because a friend of mine was just diagnosed recently with this disease, and he's a young man in the prime of his life, and it is a difficult situation to see people who are so vigorous being, succumbing to this. So we certainly do need to do something.
Any other discussion? Let's call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Aye.
Representative Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Knoll.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Joint Memorial Aid having our majorities have passed, and who would like to carry? Senator Morissette, carry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Yee, for bringing this. And we'll close the work session on SJM 8. Meeting on next week.
No, the board needs to be at 4:00. Is Gary coming in there? We could just do that, maybe. Because we may get wrapped up. Everybody find my stuff. Oh, yeah.
I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 303. Yeah.
Senate Bill 303 allows the Director of the Department of Human Resources to organize and reorganize the department without prior approval of the Legislative Assembly. I think that was the original bill. It requires the Director to consult with service providers, advisory committees, and county governments before reorganization. It requires the Director's authority in compliance with federal requirements relating to both rehab, allows the Director to exercise authority already granted to DHS divisions and offices, allows the Director to serve with the pleasure of the governor, and it renames the Department of Human Resources to the Department of Human Services and renames the related accounts and programs and makes July 1, 2000 the operative date for name changes. This bill was heard in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee, and as you can see from their staff measure summary, it was voted out with a 5-0-0 vote. It passed the Senate 28-0 with two excused.
Another controversial bill. Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Resources. Hopefully it's not a controversial bill, Mr.
Chairman. I was being facetious.
Yeah, I know. We had a very good hearing, set of hearings with Senator Fisher's Human Services Committee, and are very appreciative of the support we got on the Senate side. And I'm here to give you a little more information than Ms. Carlson has, although she's outlined the bill very well. This bill was presented by the department with the support of the governor, and it aims, as the staff has told you, to try to get for the director the authority that's necessary to effectively manage the department in a way that we think you would want it to be managed, and in a way the governor would want it to be managed, and also to get for the director the authority that's now held by all the division administrators. This is my fourth agency that I've managed. It's the first time I've ever been in an agency where actually the people that I appoint have more authority than the director does in certain areas. And while that's been workable for the last 4 years, it's also something that I'd like to see corrected in this bill. And I don't know whether you want to walk through the bill, or maybe I can just give you the highlights and you can step through the bill if you'd like, Mr. Chairman. Let me start with the name change, which actually appears in Section 1. Of the bill, and there are a couple of reasons to bring to you a change in the name of the department. I think the first and the most important reason is that this is today not a Department of Resources, it's a Department of Services. Services that are intended to try to help people become as independent as possible, to help people become self-sufficient, to help people move forward with their lives, or to provide people with the kind of supports that they need, whether they're in protective care or they're seniors who need supports at the end stages of life. The point is, it's a department that's aimed at providing services to people, not resources. So that's, I guess, the principal reason that I'd bring to you this request to change the name of the department. And then secondarily, Department of Human Resources, or Human Resources, is a term of art today for personnel operation. The Department of Administrative Services is our best example. The personnel shop for the state of Oregon is called the Human Resources Division. We get literally hundreds of calls every month from people looking for work who call the Department of Human Resources, thinking they're calling the state's personnel shop. Just the other night, I was working and took a call from someone who was a graduate student who was doing research work on state personnel issues, and I made a mistake of picking up the phone about o'clock and spent some time trying to explain to him about the personnel issues and stuff. But just one example of many and stuff. So the main change we think is an important distinction to make. When I was before the Senate committee, I was reminded by the chair that they purposely had changed the name of the committee to Human Services because they didn't want it to be considered a resource committee and stuff. So you have other reasons for not changing it, but I was the Senate chair was very careful to point that out to me. So anyway, that's in section one. Section four of the bill has a language in there that deletes the 4-year term for the director. In virtually all other agencies and state governments, there isn't any term of office for the administrator because the governor holds the appointing authority. And you, acting through your Senate, get the confirmation authority. So in most other agencies, you have a director appointed by a governor, confirmed by the Senate, and serving then at the pleasure of the governor. And so we've tried to amend this language to make it consistent with all other agencies, and the Senate found that to be acceptable on their side. The I think the meat of the bill is actually in section six itself, where you find the language that gives the authority to the director to organize and reorganize the department as necessary to perform the duties expected of the department. And just by way of at least one example, there is existing language, as you'll see there, which gives the director the authority to transfer certain organizations and combine certain organizations. But the AG has told me more than once that there's no authority to create new entities within the department. And in 1995, this legislative assembly directed the department to combine all of its administrative services into a single administrative service, which I think was a very good move. In the sense, bringing together all the information systems into one, all the personnel systems, all the accounting systems, all the payroll systems into one, rather than six operations within the department. So we did that, and in doing that, my intent was to create a administrative services division with an assistant director in charge of that. As we worked that through, the AG said, you don't have any authority to do that. You can't create a division, and you can't appoint people that are called assistant directors. The statute doesn't give you the authority to do that. So as a way around it, I created an Office of Finance and Policy and Personnel reporting to me. So that meant much more longer line, I guess I should say, of direct reports. That was the only way I could get around it, to have a single Office of Administration. The changes in this bill would allow the director to create those kinds of structures within the department and also to create positions that would be needed to oversee those. There's no fiscal impact on any of this because all the positions would be under existing classifications, or any future positions would be classified according to the DAS personnel rules. I'm trying to go fast because I know you have a large agenda, Mr. Chairman. Section 6, I mentioned to you, also gives the director the same authority as the division administrators do. And by way of another example, in 1997, this assembly approved a program for parents who have profoundly disabled children. It's called the Medically Fragile Program. The idea was to provide payments to parents who were taking care of their children in their own home. It took us about 7 months put that program into place because there's no authority for the director to provide payments to families. There's authority to provide payments to counties and so on. And we finally managed to finagle a way to do it. But it was a great frustration, frankly, to all the parents of those children who were waiting for some support in this. So Section 6 would, again, get us beyond that problem. I need to make sure that I remind you that any kind of change that a director would make in this agency that would transfer funds or create new divisions and so on like that still requires a presentation to the legislature. So we haven't amended any part of that statute that takes any ability for the legislature to oversee all these kinds of changes, or the emergency board when the legislature is not in session. I should have mentioned to you also, under the name change, we have that name change effective July 1 of the year 2000. That's to give us time to use up the stationery and business cards and letterhead and whenever we reprint brochures, so that there's no fiscal impact when you change the name. During the discussion on the Senate side, we had several meetings with advisory groups and councils that we worked with regularly on this bill to try to make sure that they were supportive of it. I believe that you have a packet of letters in front of you that represent comments from the Oregon Healthcare Association, which represents all the nursing homes and assisted living facilities, the Rehab Association, the Disabilities Commission, the United Seniors, the AAAs, and Developmental Disabilities Councils among them, are all people that have written letters to us when we were on the Senate side in support of the bill. So we think we have a bill that provides appropriate authority for the director to effectively manage this agency. It still gives the legislature the final oversight, as well as the governor, and also has the support of the key groups that we work with. So, in a very large nutshell, that's what we bring to you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Gary.
Representative.
Does this give you now the ability to create one single case management system?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, we're working on one single case management system now. This would indeed move us in that direction, because there's no question of the director's authority. I mean, we're trying to build, as I think you know, a system where we can track clients in a variety of ways. And we now have what's called the TRAC system, which actually operates with AFS. That's used in some field offices now as a beginning of a tracking system that would be universal.
It's always been the dream of some of us who were involved when we created human resources back in the late 1971 that we would have a single tracking system.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really pleased to see that you're doing that, and that some of the obstacles that were there in the earlier years are being peeled away.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Winters, they are being peeled away, but it's like peeling an onion. There's a certain amount of tears that come with that peeling away, and in the sense that things like confidentiality, we continue to struggle with that, although I think we've made some real inroads in our ability to share information across divisional lines, and share information with some key partners. We have county partners that are real important to be able to share information with on mental health and public health issues, too, and I think we've made a lot of progress with that. But I need to tell you that there's still work that's got to be, we got to keep pressing on that issue.
Representative Canal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Weeks, in Section 6 of this bill, subsection C, which you described as the meat of the bill, I would agree with that, includes the statement that you can organize or reorganize the department, and goes on to talk about different things. But I'm interested in the part about county governments.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me what you have in mind or why that's included in this particular section?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knote, we included that specifically as this was an amendment to the original bill. And there was a strong sentiment from a lot of the organizations that are advisors, as well as county government, that they wanted to see it clearly said that as we reorganize, we would go out and consult with our partners. Now, as a matter of practice, we do this already. I mean, I have a local government advisory committee that's made up of 12 county commissioners that meets for a day every month. And I created that when I took this job. And they are very involved in not only the organization of the department, but the development of the budget for this department, the presentation for this department, and so on. But this language provided a lot of comfort for some people who wanted to see it in the bill clearly stated that we would be consulting with our partners before we take action.
Second question, not really a follow-up. Also in this section, we're eliminating some language regarding organizational changes and the fact that in this section, according to, I guess, the law right now, can't be made except for the approval thereof by a joint resolution of the legislative assembly. I guess the way I'm interpreting this is that Section 6 gives you quite a bit of a power or broad powers to reorganize and organize the agency. Yet I don't see any new accountability or any particular oversight from the legislature other than, of course, the budgeting process. But why are we removing this language? Has this been inhibiting you from doing what you need to have done?
Well, let me answer that a couple ways. First of all, if you look just a couple lines above, in lines 21 and 22,
okay,
this is old language or existing language, clearly says that any transfer of appropriations between any budgets or any other organizational unit or office changes can't be done without first the approval of the Legislative Assembly or the Emergency Board, should you not be in session as a full assembly. The language that was deleted there, we deleted it because it was already, it seemed like redundant to other existing language. And it's not my intent that I do want the authority to manage the department. I want to be clear about that, but I can't imagine a director making a major change in the structure of the department or a transfer of resources without coming to the legislature. It wouldn't happen. But it's guaranteed Representative Canope in that language.
Another question. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity.
Closed public hearing on Senate Bill 303 and a work session on Senate Bill 303. Representative Winters. Representative Winters has kind of made the motion. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, we'll start call the roll.
Representative Winter?
Aye.
Representative
Spinner? Aye.
Representative Turkey?
Aye.
Representative
Horst? Aye.
Representative Lehman?
Aye.
Representative
Snow?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. Senate Bill 303 having received the required majority is declared passed. Who would like to carry? Representative Winters will carry and close the work session on Senate Bill 303. And we are going to open a public hearing very slowly while Janet goes to get Representative or Senator Shields on SJM 7. It's right next door, so I should just take it. The senator was on kind of the right time.
We haven't done anything
that's
done
at
JM 8.
That was all we had done, yeah.
I'm going to do an
order
real quick.
Yeah. Let's
Mr. Chair, are we about through hearing House bills now? Are we?
Yeah.
Representative,
the House bill that's on the agenda, we've talked about how to chunk this thing, so we just brought it back to reinsert that.
Oh,
the goal is to be done by the 25th, maybe.
Of what month?
I want to leave that open just so I can achieve the goal.
Smart move.
As long as we have time for today at any point in time, it's going to pass everything. So.
You're going to close this right up and how she said the color. SJM 7.
Do you want to round things before you talk about it?
One.
Senator, we've been waiting for you. Not long, however.
My apologies. They literally needed my vote in the other room. Right behind you. Nothing like relaxing moving from one room to another.
We are in a public hearing on SJM 7.
Okay, I'd like to talk to you and just answer any questions you have about it. You do have some testimony from me, but in the 4 or 5 years that I've been looking at this issue, I'm just absolutely convinced that we have to address the issue of long-term care in a more responsible way than we've been doing it. I have some human as well as financial implications in my testimony that I'll click down, and this affects some of you and doesn't affect others of you. I mean, you know, young Generation X types like Representative Lehman over there don't count. But it does say that every 8 seconds in America, a baby boomer turns 50. Now, the reality of that is that half of those people will need long-term care at some point in time. But currently, only 3% of the population has any kind of long-term care insurance. You put that in juxtaposition to my third bullet, which is that 80 to 90% of our federal Medicaid dollars are used during the last 2 years of life, and you see why we have a federal problem with the exploding cost of Medicaid and Medicare. On the human side, we have individuals that get divorced so that they can qualify for Medicaid to cover them in a nursing home. That's a kind of an insanity that's going on in society. And at the other end, we have individuals who impoverish themselves quite quickly due to their long-term health care needs, and then they end up using Medicaid. I was at a conference in California maybe 3 years ago on this whole long-term care situation, and I got the job. I didn't want it, but I ended up with the job of reporting back for a work group to the larger body, and I ended up taking my report and turning it into a little speech, and my little speech was entitled "Don't Make Grandma a Crook." I did it to catch the attention of legislators who'd been from several states into too many meetings that day, you know. And once I said that, I did have people's attentions. The fact is that we create situations where the elderly literally illegally transfer their assets to their children to be eligible for Medicaid. In other words, we create an environment where we tempt people to be dishonest. Now that runs, I don't know about you, but that runs totally opposite to the American dream that I grew up understanding the American dream to be. In this country, we like to be able to pass on some of our assets to our children when we die. This system instead takes our elderly and reduces them to poverty. I believe that we need to promote public policy that rewards responsibility and promotes dignity for elderly people. My preferred approach is to provide incentives for the purchase of long-term care insurance. I'd like to see Oregon provide a tax credit for those that purchase long-term care insurance. There is a House Bill 2080 in the Revenue Committee that does that. I think we also need to educate the public on the importance of planning for long-term health care needs. But in addition to that, the tax credits and the public education, we need what's called an assets waiver. I believe the state of Oregon should say to individuals who purchase long-term care insurance that they can preserve their assets and pass them on to their children if they still need further long-term care costs after they use up their insurance. These responsible Oregonians should be eligible for Medicaid without impoverishing themselves. When we developed House Bill 2080 during the interim, I promoted the idea of an assets waiver. I learned at that time that the federal government has what's called the Omnibus Reconciliation Act of 1993, and it requires states to recover from the estates of all persons receiving services under Medicaid. In other words, they got to go recover everything that they can from those estates. But in 1993, there were already four states, California, Connecticut, Indiana, and New York, that had effectively implemented an assets waiver program like I wish Oregon had. But once they passed the 93 legislation, no other states were allowed into the game. Those four states have continued their program, but none others have been allowed. And what this basically says to Congress, SJM 7, is please remove the disincentive that's in the Omnibus Reconciliation Act of 1993 so that states can provide incentives for the purchase of long-term care insurance. There is a bill in Congress that does this. This, going to our own legislators there and to others, is saying, come on, let's do it. The bill won't solve all the problems of long-term care, but it will become one of the necessary steps to get where I think we need to be in what I consider a comprehensive set of incentives, tax credits, assets waiver, public education, so that consumers understand the importance of planning for their long-term care needs. There's a lot more I can say about it. I've thought about this for a long term time, and I'd be glad to answer questions. It both grows out of my working with a lot of elderly people as a clergyman, and then in the years that I've spent in human resources down here in the legislature.
Questions?
Do you have questions for me?
Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things I noticed that we ought to try to do in the last sentence in this bill on the first page, if we could let her eliminate five letters, it wouldn't have to go over on the back sheet of the...
You know, I'd take that up with legislative counsel. I'm into saving paper.
I also just want to acknowledge what the good senator is doing in talking about dignity for elderly people. And both at a personal level and legislatively, he's doing a lot to bring dignity to people of advanced ages. I mean,
just, as I get older, yeah.
Yeah, just his hair alone is a justification for growing old in America.
If I can try to redeem from Representative Lehman something worth commenting on, there was actually a woman in Vancouver who was taken to court. There was a trial because she illegally transferred assets. I don't know if she knowingly did it. I didn't follow the case closely. But if you're a parent with middle-aged children, a grandparent, whatever, your first inclination is to give your children whatever they want. Your first inclination is not to look back at Washington, D.C. and say, is this going to be illegal, giving away these assets? After all, they're mine, you know. But if it's your estate you're giving away, you're in trouble.
Mr. Chairman, on a serious note, what Senator Shields points out is a very interesting thing. When I practice law, and I don't know that it's a loophole or technically, it was the law. And it used to be a 6-month waiting period that you could not apply for public, for Medicare within 6 months after transferring assets. And I had a couple come in to see me. Actually, their children come in to see me. The couple had a total estate of about $45,000, including at that time about a $30,000 home and some money in the bank. The husband, as I recall, was in very bad medical condition. They wanted to transfer all the assets because he needed to go into a nursing home. So he transferred all the assets from the husband to the wife, and he was now qualified to get Medicaid and go into a nursing home. Prior to going into the nursing home, the wife died. And shortly thereafter, the husband died. And we ended up having to do two probates, moving the estate, this $45,000 estate, from the wife to the husband, and then probating the estate and moving it to the children. In the best of situations, that would be a good news for lawyers. I had a difficult time in that. At that time, I was still young enough to have some ethics, I was able only to charge them for doing one estate because I felt so bad by what had done. But it was one of those situations where trying to tweak this system in a way, clearly it was not a financial windfall. The kids didn't care about it a bit. But trying to protect those small amount of assets so the surviving spouse had it, essentially we guessed wrong, and the net effect was nothing because both parents had died within a period of time that Medicaid didn't come into play. But we ended up with a terrible situation manipulating the small amount of money in this estate, trying to play within that law to protect one or the other spouse. So the point he raises is a very good one.
Yeah. Representative Knoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's amazing the confessions you can get when you have a reverend in the room. Actually, I wanted to disagree just slightly with the senator in regards to this, and that is that this doesn't affect everybody, and it does. And I think that's the reason that you see that only 3% of people in the population have long-term health care insurance is because they don't believe that it pertains to them, and it does. And I think you've got to the problem right there is how do we incent people to go out and do what they really need to do, which is protect themselves and protect their assets and protect their kids. And so this is going to affect all of us in society because of healthcare costs and family budgets and how it's going to affect end-of-life assets, as we just heard from the good attorney, the ethical attorney from Coos Bay. So I knew you wanted to comment on that, but
I absolutely do agree with you. The reason only 3% buy this long-term care insurance, number one, is that most people say to themselves, well, I don't want to die in a nursing home. Why would I want to buy this insurance? But once you can convince people that you know, it's not just for a nursing home, it could be for foster care, it could be for in-home care, or whatever, once you get those incentives taken care of, you've got the federal government in the way. Imagine a world in which you could buy maybe a long-term care insurance package that had a total benefit package of $200,000 or $300,000. And if you had paid those premiums over 20 or 30 years for that long-term care insurance, all right, imagine what it would be like if you bumped up against that ceiling when you were elderly and you needed it, okay, and you were then able to go directly into Medicaid without gutting your personal estate. That's the whole idea behind it, but the federal government gets in the way of it. I'd buy it in a minute. You know, buy the insurance, because what I would be doing is not just buying long-term care insurance to cover the cost of a nursing home. I would be insuring my estate. I'd be insuring the fact that I could pass on to my children the assets that I'd accumulated in my life. That's what I think the American dreams about. But at this point, that Omnibus Act of 93 gets in the way.
What is inheritance tax? So that's another issue. Representative Taylor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your coming forward with these measures, and I probably should declare a conflict of interest. But I know that 2080 calls for a tax credit for persons who purchased long-term care insurance, and that has a limit on it. And I've actually penciled that all out for myself and my husband to figure out where we would be under your bill, and have no problem supporting it, even though it obviously is an asset for me. But on the federal level, how do we do both things? How do we contain costs while disregarding assets? I mean, we talk a lot about means tests for different programs.
I would like to suggest to you that if in this country, even 10, 20% of the population would buy long-term care insurance, that we would literally save billions of dollars of Medicaid, Medicare money. Okay? I had a lot of radical ideas that never made it into any kind of bills. You know, just thinking off the top of my head, and I'm not suggesting these, but even if you gave people something like an income tax deduction for premiums or part of the premium of a long-term care insurance, I think you'd end up saving so much money in Medicaid, Medicare that you'd save a lot more than you'd lose by giving the income tax deduction. Of course, that's all federal legislation. All I was doing was just brainstorming, you know, potential ideas to get people off the dime. I have joked that this is probably the most Republican idea I've ever had, because it's, you know, it's private enterprise trying to solve a problem and actually keep government out of the equation. Does that begin to answer you?
Yes, thank you.
In fact, it's a conversation with Senator we can have and know that we aren't going to disagree on, so we have a comfort level. We can go through whenever we need to. Any other questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
You bet. Glenn Dayton, pay you net.
Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Glenn Dayton from the Oregon Healthcare Association. And frankly, I think Senator Shields has done an excellent job of explaining the need for this bill. the need for all of us to plan for our own long-term care needs, the consequences associated with having to spend down through your assets in order to receive services that you need. So I will only say that we strongly support this bill, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America, and we also strongly support the bill. I think that the only thing that I could add to Senator Shields' comments are the fact that when Congress looks at these issues, they're focusing on the health care component in Medicare, and they're not looking at the long-term care component. And the demographics are absolutely overwhelming if you take a look at the pressure that there's going to be for those kinds of services. And I speak most extensively when I talk about what I consider to be covered in long-term care. So I believe that this this memorial is appropriate in that it helps put more pressure on Congress to say this is an issue that needs to be dealt with. And we need these kinds of options in order to come up with solutions that are going to help us out down the road.
Questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to close public hearing on SJM 7, open work session on SJM 7.
Chair,
Representative Piercy.
I move Senate Chair Memorial 7 to the floor of abuse application.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Any discussion, question? Discussion, Representative Lynch.
Chair, I just want to clarify the record. I know the chair in passing referred to the estate tax, and it's really important to make the clarification. The estate tax applies to estates in excess of probably $1 million, whereas this applies to estates considerably below that amount. So not to confuse those issues, and knowing full well the chair didn't intend to confuse those issues, but just being clear about that.
No, I was speaking of a matter of principle and philosophy in that area, and I think we're in a similar vein. But thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative
Taylor.
Aye.
Representative
Christie.
Aye. Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative
Knope.
Aye.
Representative
Post.
Aye.
Chair
Cruz. Aye. Senate Memorial 7, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Who would like to carry? Representative Lehman will carry. Thank you, Senator. And I'll close our work session on Senate Joint Memorial 7.
Do you want to do
everything FDR1? FDR1. And here's the peer on it, and you can sign it. Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 1. Deb?
Mr. Chairman, I apologize. I had another hearing.
No problem.
For the record, my name is Ed Hughes. We're Oregon's veterans. And I don't know what you can say about General Carl, a war hero, United States Marine Corps, aviator, pilot, and hero at home even. And I get a little emotional thinking about it, but he was a hero to the last. Did the very best job he could, and I think his spouse is now alive thanks to his actions. And it's unfortunate these things go on, but what can you do? Maybe work harder to strengthen families. I don't have any more to say.
Thanks, Ed. He's from my part of the world, and he is a hero. He sacrificed his life for his wife's life. I guess one consolation we have is that his killer received the death penalty, and which I think was incredibly appropriate.
Yes.
And we did have, for once, some relatively swift justice.
Yes.
So, any questions? Just for the committee's knowledge, the Senate passed this and had a ceremony with the family there. I was not intending on going to anything that elaborate. She's a rather private person and would just as soon live her life in relative anonymity. So we would pass this and just send a letter of acknowledgement and let that go is probably all the ceremony we'd do on the House side.
Excellent, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Well, we will be. Seems like I can grab this hammer. Okay. I closed the public hearing on SCR 1 and open work session.
Mr. Chair, I'm honored to move Senate Concurrent Resolution 1 to the floor with the Disaster Commission.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters?
Aye.
Representative Taylor?
Aye.
Representative Piercy?
Aye.
Representative Lehman?
Aye.
Representative Hill?
Aye.
Representative Close?
Aye.
Chair
Cruz. Aye. SCR 1, having received a required majority, is declared passed, and the chair will carry. With great humility, the chair will carry. And I will close the work session on SCR 1.
You want to vote through there?
Okay. Well.
You can just do it.
Okay.
I
wrote it down.
Okay. Okay, we have a House bill we have to reconsider. Before we can do that, I would entertain a motion to suspend the rules.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I so move.
Representative Canopa has moved to suspend the rules. Are there any objections? Hearing none, the rules are suspended. Would you move, Representative, to reconsider 3264?
Chair, I will move to reconsider House Bill 3264.
Representative Canopa has moved to reconsider House Bill 3264. Is there any objections?
Why do we have a bill back?
There was a piece missing we got to put back in. Okay. Is that an objection, Representative, or just a question?
No.
Okay. Hearing no objections, we are reconsidering House Bill 3254, which means 3264, excuse me, so I will work session on House Bill 3264. We have a -1 amendment, which was something that was inadvertently left out at legislative council, I believe, isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, what happened was is the bill went to legislative council, and they inadvertently missed the section, which we believed was in the bill. This was an important section, and the reason we sent it to Ways and Means was for them to look at it. Without this section, they really wouldn't have anything to look at. So it's kind of critical that we add the section back. So this is why we have the -1.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Taylor.
Does the amendment then replace the bill, or is it just the meat of the bill, or does it change the bill?
I believe it adds a Section 3, or after on page 2 of the bill. And then it renumbers. Three. Section 3A is what it becomes.
Representative, what it does, it gives definition to eligibility, which is kind of what Representative Knopf talked about, it being kind of the meat of the bill. Without that in there, it really doesn't give them much of a bunch of programs, I mean, to even consider. So we felt we should, if we're going to send the product away from Means, we ought to send them maybe a more complete one than what we inadvertently did last week.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move -1 amendment to House Bill 3264.
Representative Colt. Nope. Move the -1 amendment. Is there any discussion? Or questions? Any objections? Hearing none, the -1s are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move House Bill 3264 as amended back to the committee on Ways and Means.
That was with no recommendation?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Any questions or discussion? Hearing none, no clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters?
Aye.
Representative Taylor?
No.
Representative Kirstie?
Yes.
Representative Lehman?
Nice catch.
Aye.
Representative Knope?
Aye.
Representative Close?
Aye.
Chair
Cruz. Aye. House Bill 3264 have received the required majority and declared passed. And I will open work session on 3264. Okay, I'm going to open up the hearing on SJM 5. Senator Gordley, welcome.
Thank you.
Trust you weren't in the wreck. You were just held up by it.
No, actually, I was not on the highway.
Oh, okay.
Fortunately, there is a pretty bad accident on I-5. And for the record, Avell Gordley, Senate District 10, the person who was going to join me in testifying on this memorial this afternoon, Mr. John Chisholm, is caught in that trap. So we're going to proceed, and I do have some prepared testimony for you. Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I wish you all a good afternoon. I am here to speak to Senate Joint Memorial 5 today, and to preface this memorial, the major funding for stroke-related research is through the National Institutes of Health. So the Heart Association has requested that we encourage our federal counterparts, the President and Congress, to increase funding to the National Institutes of Health for additional stroke-related research. Again, I'm pleased to be before you this afternoon. At some point in the future, you may hear from Vice President of the Oregon Heart Association, Mr. John Chisholm. You have an attachment to my testimony, which was provided by Mr. Chisholm, that shows the comparisons, Oregon stroke age adjusted death rate per 100,000 being among the highest in the nation, even though Oregon is among the lowest in cardiovascular disease and coronary heart disease age adjusted death rates. That's the attachment to the testimony. I had wanted to defer to Mr. Chisholm for more detail on the research and data needed for stroke prevention and treatment, but I do want to share with you the positive work that is occurring right here in our own state around this issue, and also in the public and private sectors in Oregon. But first, I want to recognize the collaborative work that involves Representative Bob Montgomery, and Representative Piercy has also been involved in the social support strategy, a strategy that cuts across agencies and is addressing critical human resources needs, including health-related needs and issues. And then, Mr. Chair, I also want to advise you that the governor has created a racial and ethnic health task force to examine, prioritize, and address health concerns such as stroke that disproportionately affect racial and ethnic populations across the state. Each of these efforts represents positive collaborations with community resources, state and local agencies, and the private health care delivery system. And I share these efforts with you just to underscore the importance of the partnerships that are taking place, such as the Heart Association, such as with the Heart Association, state and federal policymakers, and the National Institutes of Health to address preventable and treatable medical conditions. I am here simply to urge passage of Senate Joint Memorial 5, and would, for the record, like to thank Mr. John Chisholm for all of his work in bringing the memorial to us. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll entertain any questions that you might have.
Questions? Representative Piercy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. We support this, and I just wanted to commend Senator Corley for all the work she's done, and she's really taken a leadership role in this social support human resource. Noticed and appreciated. Thank you very much.
Appreciate
it. Senator, I just looking at this map, which is very interesting, do you have any kind of understanding at all why this is such a significant difference between cardiovascular disease, coronary heart disease, and stroke for Oregon and Washington, particularly that there's these two of them were the lowest and one of them are the absolute highest? Is there any explanation for that out there that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lehman, I'm sure there is. I am not the expert in this area, and I would have to defer to others such as Mr. Chisholm for that information. Would be happy to get a response back to you.
Mr. Chair, just curiosity. And
sure.
Mr. Chair, I would also note that once you're elected to the legislature, you become pretty much an expert in anything, so you're free to give your opinion as to what that you.
And we've noticed you exercise that authority on a regular basis.
I would like to observe that once you join the legislature, your blood pressure goes up considerably.
Yeah, there is a doctor of the day. I've learned, though, that sometimes the doctor of the day isn't in, and I don't have an answer for that either.
Any other questions? Thank you. Were you wanting to speak on 313 also, though? Or?
That was
we'll just hold that off until.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close the public hearing on SJM 5 and open work session.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Close.
I move SJM 5 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Close has made the motion. Any discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Winston.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Kirstie.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Hill.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Chair Cruz.
Aye. Senate General Memorial 5, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Carrier. Okay. Representative Close will carry. Now, close the work session on SJM 5.
And we have people here on sort of the 65 and 310, but not 313.
Okay. Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 265. What is this?
Can I tell you what
it's about? Yes, just a little bit. You wouldn't.
Representative Cruz and members of the committee, Senate Bill 265 increases the daily compensation for members of the Board of Medical Examiners. And this was a bill also heard in Senate Committee on Health and Human Services, passed 302, went to the Senate floor and passed 23 ayes, 4 nays, and 3 excused. Not a very long bill. It has a fiscal impact of $123,860 in other funds, but is included in the governor's recommended budget and has no anticipated effects on local governments or districts.
Okay. Kathleen.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Medical Examiners. Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present testimony today on Senate Bill 265, which would increase the per diem for board members from $30 a day to $250. This was last raised in 1975, and it is included in the budget, which has passed both the House and the Senate at this point. The Board of Medical Examiners has 11 board members, 9 physicians, and 2 public members. And those members, depending on assignments to committees, can serve 30 days per year. what is happening to the board, which is why we're bringing this bill at this time, is that we're having increasing difficulty getting physicians to come and serve on the board with the amount of time that's required and a loss of income that they face. We're also, for the first time in the 110-year history of the board, we've actually had a board member resign because of the required commitment. In the past, we had board members who were able to serve two full terms of 8 years, and this is not happening at this time. This bill has the support of the Oregon Medical Association, the Osteopathic Physician Association, the Physician Assistant Association, and the Oregon Acupuncture Association. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have at this time, and again, I thank you for the opportunity to present testimony today.
Other questions?
Thank you, Vice Chair Piercy. Do you think you're going to have any trouble getting public members at $150 a day for these?
Madam Chair, Representative Knope, I hope not. We have in the past had independent business people for the most part who also, I'm not just talking about the physicians, but the public members also do make quite a commitment.
Do you have any problem amending this bill to also include legislators? $100 per day a month?
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you attempt to draw from all across the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, by statute, the physician members come from all around the state, and we also try to do that with our public members. One of our public members is now from Sisters. One is from Portland.
Currently, what area are you having the most difficulty with in getting representatives?
Madam Chair, Representative Winters, it's hard to get people from far, far away, and we're hoping to recruit someone from Ontario right now to the board. But it's hard when we ask a lot of them. But they are a working board, and we try to be very communicative of the requirements and what we need when they come on the board.
How frequently do you meet?
The investigative committee meets monthly. They're meeting tomorrow, and we start about 8, and we go until business is done. And they're making decisions on disciplinary matters. And then the full board meets 4 times a year for 2 days, and then we have a variety of other committees that meet regularly.
Just a question that I had. Are there any ways that you think that the people who participate in this board should be recognized, that they are not being recognized, that might be an encouragement for that, for the kind of participation that you're looking for, other than monetary?
Well, Madam Chair, we do try to feed them pretty well.
Well, that's a good
thing. Well, it's good and bad, you know, then they gain weight and then they blame us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Watkins. I guess Jim Anderson could come up as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Jeff Watkins from the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, and you're testifying in support of the bill. As you know, physician assistants are regulated and licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners. And I don't know if any of you feel bored one of these days and want to do something educational, but I got the chance to actually go and sit in on part of a Board of Medical Examiners meeting. And when Kathleen says that they're a working board, that's really an understatement. I was very, very impressed with what they have, the decisions they have to make, and the information they have to consider, and the professionalism. It was really incredible. It was very impressive. And if anybody needs a little extra recognition for the work that they do and the importance of the work they do, it would be the Board of Medical Examiners.
Madam Chair, Jim Anderson, the Oregon Medical Association. I'd like to add our support to this bill, too, as Ms. Haley said, the OMA is in support of this bill. We have some very qualified people out there that without compensation such as this, per diem such as this, I don't believe they would otherwise choose to serve, and that would be a shame. This has passed Ways and Means. It has been approved. The dollar figure has been approved, as the chair had mentioned earlier. And again, we would just urge you to pass this on to the floor for the due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Now, for a public hearing on Senate Bill 365, an open work session. Representative Piercy.
I'll move Senate Bill 265 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Piercy has made the motion. Is there any discussion? clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Turkey.
Aye.
Representative Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Knope.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Chair Food.
Aye. Senate Bill 265, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Carrier. Representative Winters. Will carry. We're all big government people here.
Red alert.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 265. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 310. Senate.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 310 allows payment to members of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council for actual costs incurred in performance of official duties, for a personal attendant for members with a disability, and for a caregiver for the member's child or other family member with a disability. This was heard by the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services, passed out with a 4-0-1 vote, passed the Senate floor, 25-0 nays, one excuse, for legislative business, and there is a fiscal impact statement that has comments that doesn't show a specific fiscal impact. It looks like it's an estimate ranging from $7,000 to $9,000 per year, and it is federal funds that compensate for this team.
Good. Charlotte Duncan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Charlotte Duncan. I'm the director of the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Council. The testimony that I prepared for you today is a bit of a tome about the council. I know that you're all very familiar with our work here at the legislature and public policy. This is, in a sense, I guess you could call this a housekeeping bill for you, but for us, it's more important than that. We have a very strong commitment to having active participation on the part of people with developmental disabilities on our council, and that those members be represented not only of people with mild disabilities, but people with more significant ones. And the purpose of this bill largely is to allow us to cover those excess costs for those individuals where more extensive disability and therefore more extensive care needs would be represented in order to allow them to participate in council activities. We found that the current state allowance of $25 a day meets the needs of most of our members, but with a few exceptions for those who are faced with challenges of multiple disability, and where the cost of child care or personal attendant care might preclude their ability to participate in council activities, this legislation is essential. The legislation basically will allow us to pay above the $25 a day per diem for those cases. Committee Administrator mentioned the fiscal impact. There would be no impact on state general funds. We're fully federally funded, and in preparing that fiscal impact statement for the Senate committee, I basically did a kind of an extrapolation out over the next few years, and that's where the $7,000 to $9,000 a year figure came from. And that's assuming that we might have a family member who had a child who was medically fragile. I think many of you have met some of those families on this session. As an example, would be an example of an individual who right now we would not be able to cover the cost of the care that they would, that their family member would require to allow them to participate. So I'm here in hopes that you will support this bill and help us out on this issue, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you. Just a comment that I appreciate your wanting to extend your council membership to persons of all range of disabilities. I think sometimes we make mistakes on some of our boards and commissions in this state because we don't afford the opportunity for people of little means to serve. So I appreciate your work and reaching out to them.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Yeah, we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 310 for work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Percy.
I move Senate Bill 310 to the floor of the Senate President.
Representative Percy has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Percy.
Almost.
Aye. Representative Marquette.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Knope.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Carefood.
Aye. Senate Bill 310, having received the required majority, is declared passed. Who would like to carry?
I'll be
glad to. Representative Taylor will carry. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 310. And that leaves us with one left. So I guess we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 313.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 316 is a bill that confers civil immunity for injury, death, or loss that results from acts or omissions of persons rendering medical assistance with automatic external defibrillators, correct? AED. Yes, I know. My eyes are getting bad. I'm reaching that age for you. Anyway. right. This is a bill that was heard in, it was actually heard first in the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services, and then by prior reference was transferred to the Senate Judiciary Committee. So that's who you see at the top of the staff measure summary. Was carried by Senator Brown on the floor of the Senate, passed 29-0 with one excuse. And if you see in the background information, at the American Heart Association, their proponents of the bill estimating that 20,000 or more deaths could be prevented each year if AEDs were more widely available to first-line responders, and clarifies that those folks are non-medical personnel, such as police, fire service personnel, flight attendants, security guards, other lay rescuers who have been properly trained. And this is the measure that Mr. Chisholm, who caught in traffic, was going to come and speak to the committee about. I believe they provided these materials in advance to the committee, and I don't think we grabbed it.
This was a bill that came out of the Interim Human Resources Committee, and we did hear testimony. And this is a great idea. I mean, there's no question about it. This is a further way to save lives. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to mention that our police department about a year and a half ago trained police officers with a defibrillator, with the idea that they are often first at the scene of an accident even before the medical people arrive, and it has so far saved a life, the fact that they were there first. And so this I see as a great idea to train more people in the use of that. It's a relatively simple thing to do. And, whoever's there first can save the life. So I think it's a great idea.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the one question I have, and maybe you can answer it having listened to it, is there an indication out there that the lack of this restriction or this immunity being offered, is there some suggestion that there is a problem in providing AEDs to more agencies because they're concerned about the liability that's imposed?
Well, there's, if you have training, there's almost an assumption of liability if you act. And the limit of liability is just to ensure that the first thing people think about is saving a life, and the second thing they think about is any potential liability.
I appreciate that, but I guess my question is this a problem that exists out there in reality, and that there has been some liability imposed upon people using the AED, or are there agencies not getting AEDs in their department because they're concerned about the liabilities imposed by the use, or is this something that is a solution looking for a problem, I guess?
I would characterize it more as a measure to prevent barriers than necessarily to solve an overwhelming problem that we have. It's just a way to give some assurance that you can if you're qualified and you're in the right position, you can save somebody's life without losing your house. So, that's basically what that provision is for. I'm going to close public hearing, and I regret Mr. Chisholm not being here, but my 5 minutes can be treacherous. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 313.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 315 to the
Representative Morissette has...
313 before the House.
...has made the motion. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Taylor.
Aye.
Representative Turkey.
Aye.
Representative Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Lehman.
Aye.
Representative Knope.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Chair Cruz.
Aye. Senate Bill 313, having received a required majority, is declared passed. But before I close public hearing, would you like to come up and say a word or two?
Here.
Well, yeah, work session, excuse me.
I just introduced myself. My name is John Pedersen, and I actually am a trainer and a manufacturer of AEDs. I work for Hewlett-Packard, and I also do a lot of training in the Northwest with first responders, EMTs, paramedics. And from a liability standpoint, just a comment is that it's beginning to be a liability if you know about this technology and you don't do anything about it. And this is what's happened with United Airlines, for instance, when they had an event on one of their flights, and so they put automatic external defibrillators on their flights, as well as Delta and American, and Alaska has followed suit. But the technology nowadays is that there is a situation where you have to get electricity to a heart that's in cardiac arrest as soon as you can. And his example is perfect with the police. They are there before perhaps EMS. And there's no way you can get in trouble with these devices. It's a very sophisticated system that detects if a patient is in sudden cardiac arrest, VFib or VTAC, ventricular fibrillation, ventricular tachycardia. And I do a lot of training. So, you know, I speak from a manufacturer standpoint that I do go out and I train the people on how to use the equipment. There is an AHA program called the AED Heart Saver course that institute and work with the people there in the front line. And then you also have to have a medical physician to sign off on the use of AEDs as well. So you work under his license. So thank you.
Is that a unit you have back there? Or?
Yes.
Could you try it on a Representative Lehman, please?
Yeah. Certainly.
Wake him up.
Gee, if his heart is really deep.
You got to find a heart.
Clerk, call the roll.
Okay. Got to find a heart.
Find a heart. That might be tough. Or...
Ooh, ow.
Yes, you
did. I'd like to carry the message. I would like to carry the
yes. Representative Morissette will carry, and Representative Piercy asked, and Representative Morissette did say with a due pass. So,
right.
Yeah. So thank you very much, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 313.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.